Good morning, all. It's great to see all of you out. Real people. I just love it. It's great. It's 9 a.m. on June 7th, 2022, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Toni Olson, Board President, and I have with me this morning Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Vice President, Commissioner Sid Logan, our Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Ann Spangler, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Assistant Clerk of the Board, Judy Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzer, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate all others who are present. Please remember, during our session, please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This is the time when the board and the CEO General Manager will study and discuss issues amongst ourselves that will be coming before the board at a later time. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Mr. Harlow.
Thank you. Good morning. Excuse me, commissioners. It is great to see everybody in person. I will say a little unusual this morning, having to put on long pants for our commission meeting.
Thank you for doing that.
You are welcome. We have a pretty full agenda, so we'll get right into it. And first up is Julie Cunningham with our media update.
Good morning, Julie. All right. Well, I'm shocked everybody doesn't have on party hats. I brought my party blower. We made it back. You gotta celebrate these days. The celebration things are few and far between.
So. Absolutely. I was gonna wear my jammy top.
That would be Scott was encouraging us all to show up. That's wonderful to see you all in person. We've been busy this week. I hope you saw that we had a story in the Everett Herald about our emergency action. Our emergency exercise up at Columbak Dam doing, and it made the Herald with lots of photos. This one features Eric Schneider and Scott Spar. There's another photo from it from the whole room. I mean, many, many groups, nice story about that. So, and then in the Stanwood Camino News, Aaron was working with them about a story on our second high voltage line to Camino. And that also was a nice story with a good photo that was attached to it as well. In other things, we had an unusual June storm. So we had lots of coverage about outages. That was a surprise. My admins news talked with us, Stanwood Camino News and Q13 Fox actually talked about it in the news. So APPA included a story. They did a story on supply issues, and our own Ted Allworth was included in that story. We have EB rebates that were included in a story in the Everett Herald. The Touch a Truck. I like stories on this. We had a Touch a Truck in Marysville, and it was covered in the North County Outlook, and they covered it twice. They did a promo for us, and then they covered the story. And finally, I hope you saw this on our very own. It's actually not so much about us, but it's about one of our very own. Did you see Monica Doppel and her adoption of a zebra in the story?
Yes, that was great.
That's about one of it. Monica Doppel is an employee here at the district. Yes. Isn't that a cool story has taken a zebra on as part of her? I love it when that happens. We have several stories coming up that are happening to be watching out for. There's a story on Mesa 2 that we keep anticipating will be running. It has not yet. We have a nice story coming up in this month's NWPPA bulletin about our DEI efforts. And Aaron's working on a story with APPA on our solar array. That's our community solar array. Plus, we have Power Talks this week, and it's featuring the Herbs with our education talking and other employees talking on things that we offer for families to do this summer. She's going to teach a little class on I think it's about power bots, and then talking about going up to SPADA and things like that our families in our area can do. And we have names for our squirrels, Zip and Zap. I hope you saw that. So things are moving along on our mascots. It's nice to be back.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Julie. Next up, as you found in the packet, was the legislative update. If you have any questions on that, and I'm also going to ask Kim to come up. She's going to talk a little bit about a recommendation on the rhythm that we want to adjust on how often the information comes in the legislative packet. So I'll turn it to Kim.
We start. I'm Kim Johnston, for the record, Director of Government Relations, External Affairs, and Strategy. Why don't we start just by seeing if there are any questions on our report?
So the letter that our delegation sent to Bonneville, I read through it, and it doesn't have anything about reference power or the fact that Bonneville legally can't go and give power or sell power back to the smelters at the rate they'd like. So what does this mean, this letter?
We have been engaged with the congressional delegation, both through PPC and ourselves in our own engagement with congressional offices on this issue, highlighting some of the legal authority challenges and resource restrictions. Personally, my read of that letter is it didn't talk about authority, and that could be purposeful.
Right.
It felt like a soft nudge versus something forceful. Yeah. Okay. So that's how I am interpreting, and we continue to have conversations.
They're not forsaking us.
I think they are here. They're definitely listening.
Okay, thank you.
Great. I did want to just make a recommendation that perhaps we change the cadence of our reporting to every other meeting. As we start to shift to the election cycle, there's less happening in the policy space and a lot more happening in the political space, which try to avoid the straight politics in our reporting to the commission. We feel like every other meeting might be the right cadence just through the end of the year when we start the session. Certainly we would go back to our regular report structure, and if for some reason there was a flurry of activity, we can always readjust as needed. Get a pulse check on how you all felt.
That makes sense to me. There's several reports we haven't had any questions on. So.
If we have a question, we can contact you. I'm fine. Yeah, I think it's fine.
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Kim. Next up is Nick Johnston to present on our Crown Castle Clinton site lease agreement. Good morning, Nick.
Nick, I'll go ahead and use the
perfect.
Yep, right and left.
Okay, perfect. So thanks for taking the time this morning to go over this. I wanted to take a little bit to discuss our Crown Castle communication site lease. The purpose of today is to go over that lease, just inform the commission of the situation and what amendments we have in the past and what we're going forward with. And then we're going to follow it up at the next meeting with to request your consideration for ratifying an existing amendment and then also approving the next amendment. Thank you. So a little bit of background on the site. The district owns and operates two land mobile radio systems.
Our screens are blank.
Operator error. My apologies. Andrew, you see him now.
Where's the turn off?
Oh, we have to turn it on.
Sorry.
We'll be making lots of notes for today's meeting. Bear with us.
We haven't been using.
We've been home for 2.5 years.
Good.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
So we own and operate two land mobile radio systems. It's essential to its safety and operations of our network. Primarily, it's used to communicate between our energy control center and crews out in the field. It's also used to communicate between the different crews. It provides an independent communication network outside of the land mobile or the cellular network, any other form of communication. And in order to keep to operate well and to keep our group safe, we have to ensure that it has good coverage throughout our area. Primarily, we use existing sites or new sites within our service territory, but due to the topology of our area, we're butted up against the Puget Sound. So we have a difficult area on the west-facing slopes of Everett, Mukilteo, and a little bit of Edmonds. We solved that by leasing a site on Whidbey Island called Whidbey Island's up site, or we call it the Clinton site. It is owned by Crown Castle, and it provides the necessary coverage for those west-facing slopes, like I had mentioned. So in 2003, the district signed a lease with then Pinnacle, now Crown Castle, and that provides the ability for us to put the antennas necessary for our land mobile radio systems to communicate to those west-facing slopes. A couple of the details of that lease, it is actually a 12-month lease with 50 automatic renewal cycles. We have the ability to terminate the lease in 180 days with 180 days notice. And currently the monthly rate is at $6,245 per month. Additionally, it's a pretty hot topic right now that we're building out for the NECTUF project, the AMI network. And this is a site that we intend to use to attach an antenna to. Any questions on the existing background of the site?
This is Mr. Olson. Was the 5% annual increase negotiated?
I don't believe it was at the time. Imagine it's just a standard lease and it's within all the other opportunities out there. So, and just to clarify, the 6,245 is today's. It wasn't what it was signed. And it includes the amendment that I'm going to go over in just a minute here.
Private tower or public tower?
It is a private tower owned by Crown Castle. Is that working? Can you advance the slide? Thank you. So in around 2019, we started investigating new backhaul for the site, and we attached an antenna or a microwave dish. And in order to do that, we had to mend the lease to allow us to put that microwave dish. So in October of 2021, we signed an amendment that added an additional $2,000 per month for us to be able to put a microwave dish on the site. The reason that was necessary is that we co-locate a inside of a building with Snohomish County 911, and we share electrical services. And we also, it's been a very good partnership because Clinton is a very difficult spot to get to. So basically the first entity that gets there notifies everybody else, performs the necessary maintenance and troubleshooting operations. Additionally, they have provided the backhaul for us because we have a couple different co-located sites. So they are able to take all the data that we get with our land mobile radio systems and transport that to our operations center and they are in the middle of redoing their land mobile radio system. And in doing so, they're actually relocating their Clinton site to a fire station on the island. It's not a big enough site for us to go there as well, so we have to stay. And that removes our ability to use them for data transport. So we looked at a couple of different options. The first one was leased services. And the quote that we got for that was $2,800 per month. It was for a very limited circuit of about 10 megabits per second. The next option was our own, which we pursued, which was the microwave system. Benefits of that obviously cost us together. It also provides a higher bandwidth, over 150 megabits, and it's our own system. So we don't lease to anybody else, so it's much more reliable. It has a lot less equipment involved. So like I said, that amendment took place, was signed by me in October of 2021, and we're going to ask for you to do that and to ratify that. Any questions on 2021? So again, talking about the ConnectUp fund, the same benefits that we get for the land mobile radio system also apply to the AMI system. It'd be very difficult to cover those west-facing slopes, and this is a prime site for us. And already located there, it's a natural fit for the network. So when Census was proposing their network, they proposed adding a site here. And this amendment is to allow us to add an AMI antenna equipment inside the shelter. So it would increase the monthly rent by $275 a month. A little bit about the coverage. It would be a little over 88,000 electric meters, 8,000 water meters, 134 devices that we otherwise would not be able to cover efficiently.
DA, is that distribution automation?
Yeah, distribution automation, excuse me. Yeah, so fairly low increase in the monthly amount, and we're located there, so back will be, and it's a familiar site to us. Again, the First Amendment executed in 2021. It's for ratification of that. And then this is approval of additional. Next steps, like I mentioned, at the next meeting, we'll be asking for your consideration for ratification and also approval of the additional amendment. Questions?
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Nick. Great job. Next up is Chris Scudder on the North Mountain Operations and Management. Good morning, Chris.
Morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. Slight amendment here is the North Mountain Operations and Maintenance Agreement. So, let me start off by saying the reason we're here is to... we are in the process right now of creating a new contract with Seattle City Light to operate and maintain North Mountain Substation. Today, we're giving you an update on that contract, and then next meeting, we're going to be asking for a resolution to sign that contract. So no actions needed today, informative only. Let me give you a little bit of context. North Mountain Substation is a substation in Darrington, Washington, serves Darrington, the outlying areas, Hampton Lumber Mills connected to North Mountain. It's adjacent to Seattle City Light 230 kV line that runs nearby, and that's how we're connected to the system. Has two transformers, and it serves about 2,200 customers and 44,000 megawatt hours in 2021. So this has a fairly significant impact. We have new load going in the area and the expected Darrington Wood Innovation Center. So keeping their lights on for our customers in that area and keeping them connected to our system is important to us. So we want to maintain a good substation up there for our customers. The previous agreement was signed in 1991. So it's been quite a while since we've gone through that agreement, and it expires at the end of July this year. So this new agreement that we're talking about today is going to replace that old agreement and basically update the agreement for 2021. New systems have been installed at both companies. It's kind of a general update to the agreement. So it's a little bit of context about the agreement itself. It's 20 years unless extended, modified, or terminated by a mutual agreement of Seattle City Light and Snohomish County. So we have quite a free rein to amend it if things change, if something, we need to add a third transformer or something along those lines. And then ownership of the substation and facilities are both shared. So Seattle City Light owns a portion of the substation and we own a portion of the substation. And maintenance of both of those pieces is a shared endeavor of both utilities. This is new to the new agreement. Each year around May, Seattle City Light is going to send us an annual O&M plan. And on the screen, you can see an example of, I believe this is the expected 2023 O&M plan. And it shows on the Seattle City Light side, what activities they're going to be doing and who's doing them. So we can kind of see who's going to be in and out and what kind of maintenance is being done. Additionally, each of these plans has a capital project if it's being done that year. For example, next year, the plan is to replace the battery system. Furthermore, each of these plans, and we're hoping to get several years in advance, so we have some advance warning. We have 30 days in case something needs to be amended or we need feel that there's some change needed.
This is Commissioner Olson. This is a major change. Go ahead. I'm pleased to see
it. It is really welcome to get a lot of visibility into what activities are being performed up there. Additionally, within these plans, there's a monthly plan. So it'll tell us in September, for example, the field operators are going to go up there and do a substation inspection. And these are anticipated. It's not exactly perfectly planned. Something can change, but this largely gives us an idea of what's going on. Capital projects are included in the month that they're expected to be complete. And then if there's something that needs to happen that isn't in the plan, Seattle's going to try to give us 30 days notice, barring emergencies. So if, say, a circuit switcher fails, then we need to go up there and fix that right away. But for maintenance and capital projects, notice. Additionally, Seattle's changing the way they do their invoicing. So we're going to get more detail on what dollars are being spent, and we're getting a new type of invoice. I don't believe we've gotten a new one yet of the new variety, but we do know that capital work over $100,000 will trigger a 30-day notice so that we have some interaction there. We don't know if prices are going to go down, but what we do know is that visibility and transparency will go up. Additionally, we want to make sure that we're keeping our system reliable for our customers and keeping our customers in clean energy. So, and I would, it behooves me to point out that this has been a really collaborative effort. In the audience with me, I have Bob Anderson, Manager of Substation Engineering, Michael Watkins from Seattle City Light, Strategic Advisor, and Joe Fina, our legal counsel. And they were all instrumental in making this agreement happen. This has been a really collaborative process to bring people together. And I think it's a great working relationship going forward. So like I said, next steps, on June 21st, we're gonna be asking for a resolution to be signed, authorizing us to sign the contract. And then the contract is expected to go into effect August 1st, 2022. So towards the end of this summer, right at the end of the last contract. With that, any questions?
I just want to say thank you so much. I'm so pleased every year when this contract comes up, it's like a cloud thing. So this is wonderful to shed light on what the costs are and are just worth the benefiting. So I really appreciate the hard work. I know.
Well, and I, like I said, I couldn't have done it without collaboration with Substation Engineering people and Seattle City Light. It's been pleasure getting this all put together. So,
thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, commissioners.
All right, great job, Chris. Next up is an update on our Arlington microgrid and Washington State Clean Energy Fund feasibility study grants. And I'm going to kick it to Nathan Zaskowski to kick off or introduce the presenter.
Right. Good morning, commissioners. Jason Zaskowski, AGM of Facilities Generation, Power Rates and Transmission. This was supposed to be Scott Gibson up here, but he is not feeling super this morning. So he is called in and he's still going to walk us through this presentation and all the great work that's been done on the Arlington microgrid. So we will start with an update on the Arlington microgrid, and then we will hear about the Clean Energy Fund 4 grants and the associated work with those.
Well, we can thank him for staying home.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he called me about 7 a.m. this morning and he was like, no, stay home. We don't want to spread anything around. And
our first day back.
Yeah, no, definitely don't want to do that. So, Scott, can you hear us?
Hope you get well fast.
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Jason, and good morning, commissioners. Again, this is Scott Gibson from the Generation Department. And you cannot believe how excited I was and how I wanted to be there and see everyone and be there in person. I've been healthy for a year and a half. And now this happens. Not good timing, but I'm glad that technology is able to make this work. So again, good morning, everyone. So Scott Gibson, Generation Department, and I'm presenting with me today is Alex Chori from Transmission and Chris Scudder from Power Supply. And also in the audience, I just want to point out supporting Clean Energy Fund 4 projects is Daryl Williams from the Tulalip Tribe. So shout out to him.
Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning. Welcome.
Yeah, so I'm gonna focus on the Arlington microgrid and then kick off Clean Energy Fund 4, and then I'll hand off to Alex and Chris. But next slide, Jason. So it's been about a year and a half since you've gotten an update on the microgrid, and a lot has happened, which I'll talk about here in just a little bit. But you can also see that we started this journey back in 2012, 10 years ago, and we have learned a lot about energy storage. And now people from all over the world are coming to our site to learn about how to do this. We have an amazing amount of experience in design, planning, construction, grant applications, things like that. And so we're definitely becoming a leader in the country. And really even a leader around the world in this stuff. Pretty cool. Next slide. So again, I'm gonna focus on the microgrid, probably about 15 to 20 minutes. I'll kick off the Clean Energy Fund and then hand that over to Alex and Chris, and they will talk about specific projects. And it's important to note that there are no actions today, but we will be coming to you to approve a resolution for the first grant next commission meeting on the 21st. All right, next slide. All right, this is a picture you've seen quite a bit, but it's just a bit of a refresher on the microgrid. And it's important to note right at the start that this project is 2 years behind schedule, but we are still under budget. So I like to be able to say that. But it was an incredibly complicated project built during an incredibly complicated time. And thanks to collaborations, which you heard from Chris Scudder earlier, collaborations are important. We had great collaborations between generation and facilities and substation engineering and construction, telecom. Nick helped us a lot. So metering, IT, Gallus Skater Group, and the Arlington Line Department too, huge help. I'd say I'm not sure that there were any organizations or departments within the utility that didn't touch this project. But thanks to all those great collaborations and partnerships, we brought this thing to the finish line and really just finished it up early this year. So this microgrid, the basics of it are generation sources. Across the bottom, we have stationary energy storage and mobile energy storage. We have a one megawatt lithium ion battery energy storage system. We also have a mobile system, two Nissan Leafs. So we can understand how the growing number of electric vehicles impacts the grid and also how they can benefit the grid. That actually has become a really important part of this project. So those are our two forms of energy storage. We also have a 500 kW solar array, about 2 acres of solar. That's our primary energy source from the sun. And it actually turned into our first community solar, incredibly successful community solar project. And Susie Oversby is the one who masterminded that and made it successful. And I know she's in the audience today too. And then just in case, we do have a diesel generator to charge up the battery in case we have an outage in the middle of winter and we're not getting enough sun to charge up our batteries. But The intent is to really rely on the solar plus storage as much as possible and really get away from using the fossil fuel, which is really the traditional source of backup power. So those are all of our power sources. Our loads are the Clean Energy Center, our backup data center, and our future local office coming online in a couple of years. All of these things are normally connected to the grid, but if we have a windstorm, an earthquake, or something like that, that damages the grid, then we can seamlessly disconnect from the grid and keep all of those loads powered up. And I say seamlessly, and that's really important. What that means is we can disconnect from the grid without the lights blinking, without computers blipping off. You don't see anything happen. And that 3 years ago could not be done. When we first started this project, utilities were struggling with this. And actually they still are. I was at a conference 2 or 3 weeks ago, and an engineer from ComEd, which I think is Chicago, came up and said that they were struggling with their system. They've been struggling for 3 years on their microgrid. They have not been able to get that seamless disconnect to work. And so we're going to connect with them and talk about how we're making it work. So we have a lot of good stories to pass along here. So it's also important to note, I should have said this right at the start, that this project really began 5 years ago, and it was conceived with the idea of creating a project to demonstrate the multiple uses of energy storage so we can figure out how to get as much value out of these things as possible. And so it started off with a lot of engineers and just 30 to 40 people in a room, all brainstorming the multiple uses, what should we do here? And that was really fun in the moment, but it turned the project into something very complicated. Our vendor, Hitachi, said it's the most complicated project they've ever worked on. So thanks to trying to make all those ideas work, but with all of our collaborations and partnerships, we actually did make it work and brought it to a finish line. Okay, let's go to the next slide.
Scott, this is Jason. If I could just want to give a shout out to Scott and the team, facilities. When COVID hit, there was a whole bunch of new requirements around construction and moving the project forward. And Scott and the team just did a fantastic job of working through those, making sure that our contractors could keep working and we could keep this project going. So just wanted to give a shout out there.
Amen.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Yeah, we learned a lot about how to persevere, struggle through, and overcoming obstacles became our motto. So this is the microgrid. Over on the right is Susie's community solar array, about 2 acres of solar. Running down through the middle is microgrid equipment, the battery up at the top. And all the switch gear, all the electrical equipment to make it all work and all connected together. We set this up on paper and thinking about it to really facilitate tours. And it's worked out really well. It made the conduit and cabling very complicated. Our contractors were not happy with this, but it made it really easy to walk people through and talk about how the system works. So that's all the microgrid equipment through the middle. And then up to the upper left is the Clean Energy Center. And farther to the left is the data center. And that open patio now sports our new solar tree that was a great collaboration between generation and facilities. So you'll see a picture of that at the end. So that is our microgrid, and it is ready for tours. And probably 20 to 30, probably closer to 30 tours just this year, anywhere from a 10-year-old all the way up to, I think it was about 50 state legislators that came through a couple weeks ago. So they were on the Energy Policy Task Force. So that was a great gathering of senators and legislators understanding how what they need to do to push energy policy forward so that we can do more of these projects. So yeah, lots of tours, Thailand, the Netherlands, San Diego, Seattle, City Light, PSE, just utilities from all over the country, all over the state. It's been really fun to show this thing off. All right, next slide. So this, we initially started off with goals that are highlighted in yellow. And as this project was built and as we learned, we added a lot more use cases to it. So this project has turned into so much more than it was originally put on paper for our goals and use cases. So we originally just wanted it to be a backup power to the data center in the future local office. We wanted to show how we could use it for grid support and peak shaving. We wanted to show how we could use it for improved integration of an intermittent resource, solar. And then we also wanted to play around with how we can use electric vehicles to benefit the grid, understand the impacts and the benefits. And then along the way, along this journey, we learned that this can really be a very valuable resource to help other utilities and customers understand how to build their own microgrid. So we've got a lot of people coming through wanting to know how they can do their own. And that actually is what evolved into Clean Energy Fund 4, which we're going to talk about here in just a little bit. Our customers want to know how they can do this now. So we've had a great collaboration with Pacific Northwest National Labs, first responders. We've probably built the safest battery energy storage system in the country. So we're doing a lot of things with the labs and first responders to make these systems safer and learn from them. In fact, that's why the Netherlands group came over. It was the Netherlands version of the National Fire Protection Agency, NFPA. And they came over to see what we were doing and how we were making it work so that they can take it back home and do the same. So, and I mentioned seamless conversion or seamless transitions. That's, we're working with Hitachi and the labs to test and create standards for these grid-forming inverters. Grid-forming inverters, those are the things that convert DC to AC, and that's what allows us to do that seamless transition from the grid to the microgrid. Pretty cool stuff. And as I said, things we couldn't do 3 to 4 years ago. We also continue to promote MESA. We're on the MESA board and that membership is growing. And we're actually going to be one of their first test cases for testing how you prove that you comply with the MESA standard. So we're still very active in MESA. And then the solar array, our solar smoothing system has turned into a pilot project with BPA. We're working with BPA to understand how we can change that solar smoothing algorithm so that it benefits the grid as much as possible. And then you're very familiar with community solar, how successful that was. That wasn't originally going to be part of the project, but it turned into a very important part of the project. And then electric vehicles, the V2G system, vehicle to grid. There's an amazing amount of interest in that. UW has written papers. Pacific Northwest National Lab has written papers about our project. Hitachi has written papers about it. So we've Aaron Swaney has been very prolific writing about our V2G. So a lot of people from all over the country are calling us to understand how we're making it work, what have been the challenges, what's working for us, what hasn't worked. And we're really wanting to understand how we can use fleet vehicles, not customer vehicles, not private vehicles, but fleet vehicles, maybe vehicles from Amazon, Hertz Rental, PUD fleet vehicles. When you have a bunch of vehicles sitting there, that can be quite a few megawatts of mobile energy storage. Buses are a great example. If they're not being used and the price is right, then maybe we can let those customers have us Let us pull the energy from those vehicles to benefit the grid, provide capacity to the grid. So a lot of learning going on there with V2G. All right, next slide. So what has happened since November 3rd of 2020, that last presentation? Well, a lot. So we had our battery arrived. Basically, all of the main equipment came in. We got it all set in place, connected up. And most of the equipment arrived in 2020, a little bit of 2021, and then 2021, and then into 2022 was spent on commissioning. And then we finished microgrid commissioning March of 2022. Did a lot of PUD and first responder training in 2022. We wanted that. We wanted all the training complete so that everybody felt comfortable with the system before we actually energized it. So that's the system was fully energized March of 2022 and went live after all the training was done. And then shortly after that, we finished up our reports with the University of Washington. That it ended up, the University of Washington reports were a requirement of Clean Energy Fund 2. That was our final milestone. When those reports were finished, we submitted them and invoiced for the final milestone, and that was done in May of this year. And that really completed the project. But back to the UW reports, it started off just being UW, but it ended up Pacific Northwest National Labs ended up contributing to their report, and Hitachi ended up contributing to their report too. So a lot of good stuff on fire protection and electric vehicles that went into that. So it's a really good comprehensive report that's now available to the public. A lot of good stuff happened in the last year and a half. All right, I think that is it. Next slide.
Yeah, and Scott, this is Jason again.
Yeah,
so that report is available. If you're interested, we can get that to you. It is a great read and has great discussion on the use cases and kind of what they found.
Yeah, a lot of stuff, a lot of focus on the economics of energy storage, the economics of V2G, Pacific Northwest National Labs really focused on the V2G part, the economics of it. Using our system as an example, but then expanding it out to buses and other fleet vehicles. So it's a really good read. Okay, here's just some fun pictures. And then we'll kind of go over next steps and then go over to CEF4. So this is when our battery container arrived, November of 2020. We were pretty excited when it showed up. They unwrapped it and took it off the truck. But this seemed to happen with pretty much every piece of equipment, thanks to COVID and shipping and transportation. But this thing came across on a truck from Tennessee. And as it came through Wyoming, it got hit by 80 mile an hour winds. And so the straps just beat the heck out of it. So we ended up having to have our crews, our maintenance shop, transportation shop, they came out, did a lot of sanding and touch up, and now you can hardly even tell that any damage was done to it. So a big shout out to transportation on doing that for us. So this got set in place, and then next slide. Then our battery modules came in, and again, the battery modules got lost. They were supposed to show up the next day. Because of all the different things that happened, we said, boy, get that on a dedicated truck and be on the phone with them all the way across the country until they get here. Well, they ended up getting lost, of course, and getting dropped off at a warehouse down by SeaTac. And Hitachi was here. They were calling around trying to figure out what happened. We finally found out that the batteries were sitting in the middle of a warehouse down by SeaTac. So much to our horror. And so they got them back on a truck and got them shipped up to us. And then our crews got busy unboxing them and setting them in place. And these things weighed 120 pounds a piece. So they had to get creative on putting these in. There were 176 modules, 120 pounds a piece. It took a couple days, and they were worn out by the time they got them all put in and wired up. All right, next slide. Here it is. The system was finished up, 1 megawatt, 1.4 megawatt hours. Samsung batteries, very reputable manufacturer. And that was critical to us for fire safety. We wanted to start off with really good batteries and then have a very, very good fire detection and suppression system just in case. So here it is, all finished up. Left to right, you got Wes Honeycutt and Travis Forts and Nate Pioli posing in front of their finished artwork. So that was a lot of batteries and a lot of wiring to get this all put together. It's really important to do a shout out again to substation construction. Without them, Dennis Montoya and his crew, I'm not sure how we would have gotten this stuff done. They just persevered through problem after problem after problem and just came up with ways to fix it and got it done. And we've just learned a lot in the process. All right, next slide. Here's our electric vehicle system, which, as I said, has really turned into an important part of the project. A lot of interest in this, and we're going to continue to write about it and study it. So we had two chargers from Mitsubishi. We had to work with Japan to make those things work, and a lot of late night phone calls with Japan because we're on different time zones, and then a lot of just translation between different languages. So that was a fun process. And Nissan was always on the phone calls helping us out. So we were working with them to understand the impacts on the battery when these batteries are discharged to the grid, because there is degradation on the battery, and we wanted to understand what that was. So Nissan was on the call with us. I think we were actually the very first grid-connected V2G system in the country. Green Mountain Power was right there with us. I think we beat them by a few days, but we're either number one or number two. But when we're islanded, the microgrid controller has control of the cars, and these cars supplement the big battery. And then when we're grid connected, our distributed energy management system, our DERM system, controls them. And that's Kelly Wallace in the power scheduling group. So then she can control the cars and dispatch them to benefit the grid. So that's our V2G system. It's been a really cool learning experience, and we're going to continue to talk about it and learn from it. All right, next one. Go ahead.
This is Commissioner Logan.
Yeah.
Are we using these cars, and are we exercising this system to, or are we just doing studies with it?
Yeah, so.
Charging into the grid and driving them and charging the whole thing?
Commissioner Logan, at the moment, the answer is not yet. So we can do that, but we're not actively driving the vehicles. We're still working on the communications, making sure that we can charge and discharge them when we want to. We're having a little bit of difficulty with the software at the moment, going back and forth between DERMS and power scheduling. But once we get that worked out, that's probably going to be in the next week or two. Then we will actively be charging these and discharging them from the grid. So I'm not sure if that it's for when we start the schedule, power scheduling can start the schedule, start the discharge, start the charge. But for some reason, we don't really know why yet, it shuts down after a couple hours. And so there's a little bug in the software that we need to really focus on and get and troubleshoot before it's 100%. And then as far as driving the vehicles, no, we're not driving them. The crews drive them to do tool pickups or do run errands, but we're not actively, the PUD is not actively using the vehicles. But as soon as we get the software glitch figured out, then the intent is to start actively charging and discharging and use the vehicles and then keep record. Keep data and keep record of how we use them, and the impacts to the cars. Does that, that was a long-winded answer. We're still struggling just a little bit with it, but we've almost got the bugs worked out.
This is Jason, and you know, I think as the North County site grows, even as we start construction, our employees up there, they'll be using them more. I also just wanted to add all the kind of knowledge we're gaining through the construction and building of this is going to be extremely useful. As we move into the future, I think we're going to have lots of distributed energy resources being integrated onto our grid, both our own customers, and you know, the knowledge we're gaining on how to integrate those, how to work with those, all the way back to power scheduling, it's going to be huge. So huge benefit there.
You know, I think it was very wise that we had Dennis and his devastation crew do that work to understand it's such a complicated piece of machinery, essentially.
Yeah.
Is it really essential, and will be helpful to others in the future. So I'm glad we didn't just buy something.
Yeah, yeah, me too. And other utilities are, yeah, other utilities are now learning from that and going, oh man, maybe we should have our crews, you know, build ours. And Dennis, I mean, the substation crew, Scott hit on it, they did an outstanding job. At one point, we had a piece of equipment show up, and it had essentially been speared by a forklift at the wherever they were transporting it, and you know, could have sent that back to the manufacturer. That would have taken lots of time, delays, those sorts of things. Dennis and the crew said, hey, you know, we could fix this. We could fix the wiring. We went ahead and did that, you know, and then just took some money out of the contract with the manufacturer. And our crews learned, you know, it's done well. It's resolved. So just a huge shout out to them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an excellent, just to kind of second that, about the substation crews doing this construction. Over the last 6 weeks or so, I've been giving lots of presentations, and three or four times utilities have stood up and said, who's building these things in your utility? Who's maintaining them? Who's operating them? We're struggling with that at our utility. We know substations, we know transmission, we know distribution, but this energy storage stuff is new to us. Who's taking care of that for you? And how did you make that decision? So, so what we learn and how things work, we're able to then pass that along to other utilities to help them with that decision. And I think every utility is going to be a little bit different, but at least what we learn helps them with that decision. So most utilities are struggling with that question. This is new stuff. How do we deal with it? Who owns it? Who operates it? Who maintains it? And I think we've made a really good call. I think substation, they now, because of all the work that they've done, they now have a really, really thorough understanding of how all this works. And it's going to just continue to grow. All right, next slide. Oh, go ahead.
This is John. Just to pile on to those comments, the benefit of our having our crews do this and a number of departments engaged in this process, I think will really help us in the future. If you think about the utility of the future slide that we have showed the commission in past presentations and how this project fits into that, and what we see as really part of our core capabilities moving forward to build and maintain and manage our grid, this is a ideal project that fits into that and really develops or enhances our capabilities to do that more so going forward. And as Scott touched on, the ability for us to put this on the grid seamlessly, that has been a huge accomplishment. In fact, during the recent tour that was provided to the group of state legislators, Bob Kirschmeyer from Commerce commented that we really need to brag about this because no other company has been able to figure that out. And again, to Scott's point and Jason's, it's been our crews working with the vendors but have figured that out. That's a huge accomplishment. And again, sets us up very well for the future.
So, if I may, this is Commissioner Wolf. It seems to connect with the trainee program as we get more new employees.
Yep.
They're going to start right in learning so much. I mean, not immediately, like at your level or Scott's level. But, you know, it's great opportunities for these young folks.
Yeah.
Boys and girls.
Yeah, yep, completely agree. And to pile on to John's comment, you know, in Mesa, or not Mesa One, but Clean Energy Fund One, there was a number of utilities that were going to try to do the just transparent switch, you know, to a microgrid from utility power to battery. And they weren't able to do it. A lot of it boiled down to the inverter technology. But, you know, to John's point, it's just amazing what Scott and the team has done to be able to do this. And I've been up there, you know, when they pulled the switch off and you couldn't see a thing. I mean, you didn't even see a blink. It was very impressive.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone. This is the last slide on the microgrid. This is just, okay, where do we go? We got this thing working. As I told Commissioner Logan, we still have some bugs to work out. We're still, software is always a little bit finicky. We've got four different companies that all have to talk to each other through different networks and firewalls and protocols and software, and it gets complicated, but we're still kind of working through that. And that's kind of what takes us into 2022 and beyond. So the intent now is to improve on the microgrid. The very first thing we're going to do is the third week in June, we have somebody coming from Hitachi, and they're going to work with our substation construction group, Nick Peretti and Matt Gregorich, and we're going to take the microgrid through everything that it can possibly do and make sure that that's in an operation and maintenance document for substation. So just make sure that they have a really good document that talks about everything the microgrid can do, and then use that for training. That's actually the second bullet. I skipped ahead a little bit because that's the first thing that we're going to be doing. And then during that, we're also going to make improvements to our SCADA system, the microgrid SCADA, how the screens look, just to make it easier for the operators to use. We're going to be working on remote access so that they can see the system and what it's doing from the phone, from their phones or from their computers. So that when they get a call out in the middle of the night, they can actually see the system and start thinking about it a little bit before they arrive on the site and start troubleshooting. And then we're going to do even more fire safety improvements, not a lot, but just a few little things that make the system a little bit safer. And then we're going to continue to do training with PUD crews and first responders, Arlington Fire Department, Everett Fire Department, anybody that is in the area that could be responding to this thing. So the intent is to, and we've already done this a couple of times, but the intent is to do annual training so the first responders and the PUD crews know each other and see each other and have familiar faces in the event of an emergency happening. And then we're going to continue to do collaborations and tours and demonstrations. I think there's no end in sight for those things. Sorry, starting to lose my voice. It's a good thing that Alex and Chris are going to be up soon. So connection, and then we've got our connection to the future PUD office, which is coming in 2024. So a lot of stuff coming for the microgrid still. All right, next slide. Let's transition to Clean Energy Fund 4. So thanks to all of the work that we've done here, we now are positioned very nicely to help our customers with microgrids. And we were actually part of a group that worked with the state to figure out how to give out additional grants for microgrids. And there were a lot of organizations that said, hey, don't just keep giving these to utilities. Let's start giving them to other organizations that might need it a little bit more. So Clean Energy Fund for grants was then established by the state for grid modernization with a key focus on tribal communities and vulnerable populations. They wanted these communities to work with utilities, but they wanted the money to focus on those communities and organizations. So that's really how that grant process started, not just for the utilities anymore, but to others. And this started last year, I think it was March. Applications were asked for in March of last year. We applied for 4 grants. We were awarded 4 grants. I'm actually going to talk about 3 grants because 2 of those grants were actually combined into 1. And that's the first one that you're going to be approving. And it makes sense that they were combined because they're for 2 buildings that are very, very close to each other. So these grants are for feasibility studies only, $150,000 each, and they're to focus on the engineering that looks at the technical challenges, the economic challenges, and the feasibility of building these microgrids. There was $1.6 million available. As I said, $150,000 max per project. 18 projects were selected. Utilities across the state, Avista, PSE, Seattle City Light, Opalco, Energy Northwest, Tacoma, there's a few more too. And we're all going to be collaborating. We're all going to be talking about our projects and learning as we move ahead with these things. And as I said, we were selected for 4 awards, but 2 were combined into 1. So now we're working towards 3. And this is feasibility studies only. If the feasibility studies prove that it makes sense to build these microgrids, then we're actually already starting to work with WSU and the Department of Commerce and trying to figure out how to leverage federal money that's going to come into the state to actually help build these things. And that money, theoretically, should start flowing into the state next year. So we're going to be trying to expedite these studies and be ready for that construction money if these studies say that it makes sense to build these projects. All right, next slide. Okay, now I'm gonna quit talking and I'm gonna hand it over to Alex Chori, and then Alex will hand it off to Chris, and then I'll wrap up at the end. But Alex is gonna talk about the first two grants and what we plan to do there. All right, all to you, Alex.
Good morning, Alex.
Right, thanks, Scott. Hey, good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everyone. I'm Alex Corey. I'm in our transmission engineering group, and I'll be heading up 2 of these projects that we have coming up for the upcoming funding. There we go. So the first of these, and before I start, I apologize. I'm not as under the weather as Scott, but the cottonwoods have got to me, and I'm used to having that mute button, but unfortunately, it doesn't exist here. So apologize in advance. The first of these projects that we have coming up is in partnership, like Scott said, with 2 Lalip tribes. And we're looking at that feasibility study for putting a small scale microgrid in 2 of their critical facilities. Their main goals that I think it will develop as we move forward with this, but in general, they're looking to increase their reliability and resilience, both short and long-term power outages. These 2 sites, they serve as tribal government headquarters, but also kind of a community gathering space. The ability to keep them up and running, at least in some form, especially during a long-term outage, is really key for keeping operations running over there. On a more kind of regular and day-to-day basis, having a solar array plus energy storage component that'll allow them to reduce their regular energy bills, but also having that energy storage piece, if there ever was a shift to a time of use rate schedule, or just in general, it allows them to kind of take better advantage of power during peak times or their loading during peak times. Both buildings right now are powered by existing diesel generators. And as Scott mentioned, this is kind of a great community-facing project, a sample project that shows, hey, this is what benefit it can provide both to the customer and the utility, and it reduces that carbon footprint, gets off of fossil fuels from the generators. It's kind of a win-win, I think. And also it's the big wrap up is it's energy security for the tribe. Provides them a little bit of generation, a little bit more stability on their side. And from a PUD perspective, it's just like Scott and Jason said, it's a great sample project. We expect technology improves and more of these small scale projects that start to pop up. We'll see a lot more customers that are looking to install behind the meter systems like this. And we'd like to explore what it means to potentially have some co-ownership in that. If the solar array and the battery are officially owned by the tribe, but the PUD has the ability to tap in and use those batteries during peak loading times, but the tribe has the ability to use those batteries in the event of a major outage, that benefits everyone. But there's a lot of coordination and details to be worked out as far as what that agreement would look like. So the feasibility study will help to clear up that, and then also the technical standards for what it means to integrate this into our existing system. So the two facilities we're looking at is the Tulalip admin building and the gathering hall. The admin building is, I think, built in the last 5 to 7 years. And as the name implies, it houses a lot of the administrative functions and the operations of the tribe. They've got tribal council chambers, and importantly, the data center is sited there as well. So having an ability to keep this running in a reduced form during a long-term outage is really important to them. So this is an ideal site to kind of showcase one of these sample projects. The gathering hall is more of a community center, and they currently hold large gatherings there now, but the intent is that during another crisis or a major outage, this would be a great spot to serve the community at large. I believe both of these buildings have showers and locker rooms, so they're kind of logical places to provide a little more stability for the community as a whole. Both of them have existing diesel generators providing backup power. As probably everyone who has a generator knows, when that power turns off and it comes time to kick it on, you kind of have your fingers crossed a little bit. So adding in a microgrid, some solar, a battery bank would just provide a little more confidence and reliability there. All right. So the feasibility study process, as Scott mentioned, for the first grant, where everything's agreed and approved between the Department of Commerce and the PUD, and we have a resolution in that we'll be looking for at the next commission meeting. And once that is approved and ready to go, we're going to start looking at selecting a consultant firm to help us out with this study. We've got the grant funding for that. This project, of course, is going to be in pretty close collaboration with Tulalip. So they'll help us with the selection of that engineering firm. And then as the study goes on, of course, they're going to help to drive what direction we want to look at, what options we put on the table for sizing and location of the solar and the battery bank, and how that ownership and kind of interconnection agreement with luck. Right now, we were very, very introduction, looking into the very beginning of it, but there's a potential to add rooftop solar on the existing buildings, but it's pretty open-ended. There's the option maybe to add covered parking spaces with solar on there, actually clear some space for ground-mounted solar. It kind of just depends on what the goals of the tribe are in terms of what they'd like to power and keep running, what their energy needs are. But also, if there's an option to overbuild it a little bit in a way that would benefit the PUD, that we could tap into that in terms of peak loading, that's on the table as well. The study also would put together some of the framework for those standards, like Scott talked about with our Arlington microgrid. We're on the forefront of developing things tie together, and not just for our crews, but potentially for the rest of the state and the rest of the country. Just explore more what it looks like to have a customer-owned system and how that ties in. That means for our existing infrastructure. And again, this is a feasibility study. We're not looking to full design or select any components, but we would like to have a very base level 10% kind of one line diagram that lays out how everything's tied together. The intent that if everything pencils out, then we could move into the next stage. So that would kind of be the first step towards the next round of funding.
that's exciting that we could potentially use that as a resource for mixed fleet.
Sure.
Real win-win.
It seems like it. And I'm new to this. I'm in transmission engineering, but as I'm coming up to speed, what I'm finding is that a lot of excitement, but not a lot of understanding out there about what this can do, both for a customer and the utilities kind of understand. But there's a lot of explaining to be done to show what the benefits can be, but it potentially is a good benefit to both customers and utilities.
Yeah.
Got a double slide here. All right. So the second project is on kind of following on the tail end of the existing, or I should say planned to exist, community solar project. That's already, design is underway. I'm sure you guys are up to speed on that. But we will be, the second grant is to perform a feasibility study for adding an energy storage component to that planned solar. That's in partnership with the city of Everett. And the goals for that, at least for the city, are probably mostly wrapped into what was discussed for the existing solar array, but it's kind of providing some reliability and some reducing the energy burden for South Everett communities and some underserved customers. The location of that is at the end of a crowded distribution feeder. It's got a good mix of residential with some apartments, but also commercial, industrial, Boeing and Painfield are in the area. So it's a good location just to see, you know, what does it mean to have one of these small scale systems integrated with the PUD. Generation is not going to be huge, but it's a great example of what's realistic for a lot of our customers to put in. With that respect, on the PUD side, we're expecting that this project probably will not be behind the meter, as the Tulalip one will likely be. This will be more by the PUD. Potentially has the ability to provide a little bit more benefit to us just because of where it's located in our system. But again, we'd still need to have that partnership with the city of Everett. About those agreements, maybe it would kind of be the mirror image. We own the batteries, but can we help out the city by allowing them to tap into that? It's situated right next to an existing drinking water facility, which again is backed up by a diesel generator, but providing some additional reliability and another option there is great. And if it's in a spot that benefits the PUD in terms of helping with loading on our system, that's even better.
That looks really quick. On the loading of those distribution feeders where the solar array will be, and those are summer peaking feeders, are they not?
I believe they are summer peaking feeders, yes.
Which is why the location of the solar project is a nice fit.
Sure. And, unlike a lot, especially like a residential circuit, you get that morning and afternoon peak. Since we've got a good mix of residential and commercial and industrial, it actually is kind of a smooth curve. So, yeah, loading-wise, it's actually a pretty ideal site for something like this.
On a hot, sunny day, we could potentially be taking power from the solar panel and power stored in the battery.
So you guys, I'm sure, are aware of the site on the east side of Walter E. Hall Golf Course in the park there. Well, up shows the drinking water facilities there. There's a little spot carved out for the planned solar array. And if this pencils out, there's the potential to carve out a little space for the battery or energy storage, I should say, as well. The timing of this is probably going to be about a month or two behind where we are for the first Tulalip project. It's a very long time to go back and forth with Commerce, just the nature of these agreements, I think. But the hope is that this first project can get kind of the baseline paperwork agreement in order. And if everyone approves this project for the South Everett Community Solar, and the project that Chris is going to talk about in a minute here, can follow a little bit more quickly.
On this project, the revenue that comes through the energy is going to go to project pride, is that right?
It is, and I'm sorry to say, I haven't been
sharing that with PUD, or if it's all, I know at the St. Vincent de Paul is doing the management of the financing market, so Susie might have answers.
Good morning. Susie Oversby, Senior Program Manager in Energy Services. And yes, the all the generation benefits from the solar project are going to exclusively go to Project Pride, funneled through St. Vincent de Paul, who administers the program.
That was my memory, but I wanted to make sure it was all going to Pride.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, Susie. And thanks to Susie for probably doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the solar project
yes.
that we can just follow along very easily behind. So appreciate it. And I think that's all I've got for those two. If there's any specific questions about those, otherwise I'll turn it over to Chris.
I have none.
I have no more questions.
Other than I'm really excited.
Thank you.
Good morning again. I'm back. I promise this is the last time you have to deal with me and then I'll get out of here. So my project is a little different. We're not really looking at a microgrid. What's going on here is we're looking to explore the feasibility of adding storage to a proposed utility scale solar plant. So Tulalip tribes are planning on exploring building a solar plant at their Big Flat site, which is between Everett and Marysville. On the tide flats there. You can see a couple pictures, an aerial view, and then one from the ground. So our partnership will be with the tribe to explore what value can be added to a solar plant by adding storage to that plant. So the tribal objectives, they want to see potential increases to the value of the energy that can be produced or the value of the project as a whole. So, and then for the PUD, we are going to look at the value proposition to us, and then additionally, how do we partner with our community to really produce a positive result for both the tribes and the community. So the project is identified to be the Big Flats project. It's in the concept phase. They're looking at 5 megawatts of utility-scale solar, and we're very open-ended on what our project can be in terms of storage. Our project, the feasibility is going to be size, scope, type, ownership. All of that's under the umbrella of what our study is looking at. So, it's an economic analysis of a solar and customer-owned utility scale solar energy resource. Any other questions for me?
Just a comment, that conceptual picture is pretty stunning.
That is roughly what it would look like if you were facing the mountains, but that is not the Big Flat site.
The llama in the previous picture has a lot of a little hole.
All right, with that, I'll pass it back to Scott.
All right, excellent. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Chris and Alex. So this is the very last slide, and then we can open it up to questions. I don't think I made this clear at the start of Clean Energy Fund 4, but this is a really important collaboration between the utilities and the tribes. We met with the tribes, Daryl Williams there in the audience, and a couple of others, and developed these projects, developed the concepts, the ideas, and submitted them together to Commerce for the awards. And as we move ahead with these, we are getting $150,000 from the state, but we match it with another $150,000 of either dollars or in-kind labor. So we'll be there. That'll be both the PUD and the tribes contributing that matching fund. And as we proceed with these, we'll be working with Daryl and his team just to make sure that everything is done right. So I'll talk more about that here in just a second. But I think that it's just really important to note that this will be a really, really good collaboration between us and the Tulalip tribe and the city of Everett too. Again, gotta not leave them out. But so the next step, excuse me, voice is starting to go. But Next step is June 21st. That first contract will be in front of you for approving and signing the resolution. Once that's signed, then John Harlow will be able to sign our contract, our CEF4 contract. As soon as that's done, then Alex and Chris will be able to start selecting their engineering firms. So Alex will be the first one to do that. He'll go out and select an engineering firm from a pre-qualified list, might interview a couple of them. He'll be doing that with the tribes, just to make sure that they find an engineering firm that's qualified and they want to work with. And then they've got a year to complete the feasibility study. We might be trying to expedite that to be able to take advantage of funding dollars that will be available next year. But it'll just have to take how long it takes, and we'll make sure that it's done thoroughly. And then actual project design and construction will occur just pending the feasibility study. If it doesn't make sense to build these, if they're too expensive, if there are too many technical challenges, then they just won't be done. So, but if the feasibility study says it's feasible, then we'll proceed with finding construction grant dollars to help build them. And we're already working with, I think I said this a little bit earlier, and Jason said it too, but we're already working with the Department of Commerce and WSU to explore state and federal grants. There's a lot of federal money. I'm sure you've heard a lot of that. A lot of federal money going towards energy storage. The state hopes to get that and then incorporate that into their grants and then hand that out to projects in the state. And we're right up there at the top of the list for potential projects. So Clean Energy Fund 4 contract one will be coming to you June 21st. And the next two, as you heard, will probably be in the next month or two. They've had some changeover of people at Commerce. They've got a new person there that's going to be handling these grants. And that person is coming up to speed. And once they're up to speed and ready, then they'll be trying to finish the second two projects. And hopefully that's in a month or two. We'll be able to move ahead with those. So I think that covers next steps. Next slide. That's it. We're just open for questions. But the fun thing is that's the Clean Energy Center, and that's the solar tree that just got finished up. That was great. That's a great collaboration between generation and facilities and substation. And that's the homeowner version of a microgrid. That shows a homeowner how they could build the equivalent of what we have on the site for a utility. So pretty fun. And we're also using that for fire department training so that the fire department would see what they might see in a home. All right, that's it from us. Any questions?
Scott, this is it seems to me, maybe you could educate me on this. It seems that all of these projects that you talked about today, you and Jason and Susie, would put us in a really good position with meeting our CETA obligations, Clean Energy Transformation Act obligations.
Yeah, Commissioner Wolf, I apologize. It's it was kind of hard to hear you, but I think you're wondering how these help us with CETA. And it looks like Jason and Garrison are coming up to help answer that question. So I'll be quiet.
Hi, Garrison.
Hey, commissioners. Hey, Scott. Virtually, Garrison Marr, Senior Manager at Power Supply. So, you know, there is some overlap with CETA, and this will contribute towards CETA. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really great that happened in the CETA rulemaking is that energy storage got a really nice rulemaking treatment where losses are not subtracted from the renewable energy that goes into those devices. So that can really help us with our CETA compliance. It's useful to know that, you know, CETA compliance is based on retail load. In the scale of the energy production that we're talking about here, you know, 500 kW here at the Arlington microgrid, and potentially a little bit smaller at some of these other microgrids isn't going to contribute a huge share to our CETA compliance, but it's a positive contribution and it is helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's important. This isn't, it's not a huge amount of energy storage and renewable energy, but as, but it'll, it shows us what we need to do and what we need to understand as we scale up to have more of a contribution towards CETA. So a lot of lessons learned here that help us scale up so that we can benefit CETA and Garrison's group from the IRP.
Any other questions or?
So, you know, I think the other thing, there's an education benefit. I think, you know, one of our challenges is getting more customers, whether they're entities or individuals, to understand our challenges to get energy. So projects like this just increases the number of people in the fold, the tribe, the city of Everett to understand, you know, what we need to do to help with peaking.
Yeah.
I have a, just a vision. This is kind of very long term, I guess, but I don't know if the tribes own the discount buildings on the property of the, do the tribes own the discount mall buildings? I was thinking with those flat roofs, maybe someday we could have solar panels on all those buildings.
This is Darryl Williams with the Tulalip Tribes. The outlet mall is actually, the buildings are owned by a company in Florida.
Oh.
The tribe owns the land itself, but not the buildings.
I see. Well, thank you, Darryl. I was wondering. Hi, this is Commissioner. Also, Darryl, I was so impressed with looking at the size of the solar array that you're
going to study. I mean,
that's scary and impressive.
Yeah, the big flat site is, if I remember right, about 167 acres that we have available for use. Mm-hmm. And for this project, you know, we still need to figure out what size would be appropriate for the site, but at least to start with, I think we're looking at somewhere around 5 megawatts of production, which it's still a small percentage compared to the amount of power that the PUD manages, but it could make a little bit of a dent in your CETA requirements.
Yeah, that's a pretty large solar project. So.
Yeah. And while I'm here, one other comment I'd like to make is that I'd really like to thank your staff for even bringing this funding to our attention, because I think it's these projects are can be very useful in the future. Particularly with our administration building and gathering hall. If there's a major windstorm or earthquake that takes out power for a long period of time, it would allow us to provide emergency services through our administration building, but also provide shelter and food through our gathering hall. We do have a sizable kitchen with the gathering hall. Unfortunately, we don't have much for kitchen facilities at the administration building. Although with our large meeting room, we could provide some emergency housing there as well, potentially bring food up from the gathering hall. So I think it'd be very helpful if these projects move forward and are actually built. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We really appreciate the partnership with the Tulalips. Any other questions?
No, very good topics this morning.
Yeah, and just a great job to Chris, Alex, and Scott, and Jason and Harrison for the overview. That concludes our briefing session, the topics that we had.
Thank you, John. It is 10:28 a.m., and the meeting is being recessed, and the regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.